conversations that you connect with and react to. SAFM.
Right, so every Thursday we have this feature called the Election Monitor, and today, speaking to different leaders all throughout the last month or so, today is the turn of Musi Maimane, the leader of Build One South Africa. So Musi, good chatting to you, and you're now live on the National Pulse. Welcome.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon to fellow South Africans. It's great to see you, Ashraf, and great to be on your show.
Thank you. Well, at a time when not just you, but every other political party, understandably, are jockeying for votes, and you want position, and you want to get to the top, and the finishing straight on May 29th, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's been an incredible election campaign, and with 35 days to go, I can feel the mood of South Africans who are all generally committed to this country, want to see change. We can feel, as we're going across all nine provinces, people receptive to our message. And so, however difficult and sometimes tiring all of it is, you got to hope, you've got to feel the pulse of a nation that is enthusiastic about change, nervous about certain things, but overall, I'm really, really, having done elections before, this is a very unique one and a very important one. Mm.
And you bring up an important point. I mean, do you get a sense that this want for change is not, and I'll talk about your party in a moment, of course, right? But it's less about saying we're going to support Build One SA, but more that we actually just want change because of an unhappiness with the current status quo.
I think it's both end. I think it's also, on the first instance, no citizen wants to wake up to darkness because there's no electricity or feel unsafe at home or invariably be lingering at home because they can't find a job. And after a consistent few decades of doing that, people eventually get to a point where they're like, surely something must be better than this. And I also don't want to dismiss that in the COVID period, many of us were glued to our TV screens, literally watching politicians loot or report after report of food parcels not getting to the intended recipients because councillors were hogging them off. And I think South Africans, it gave us a universal language that then began to say, we need change. Now, of course, the job that like we have to do as Build One South Africa is not only just to say to them, this is what's wrong with the current status quo, but to say, well, this is what this change will mean. And that's been the hard work that we've had to bake into the thing. I think it's almost universally accepted that we need change. What the question is, what happens after the change? And we've really baked our message into saying, well, that change must put a job in every home, we must make sure people are safe, and we must educate our kids. But that is the hard work that we had to do.
Mm. You've also been very clear, and I'm looking at it both in campaigns, but also, you know, I suppose social media platforms are a campaign platform anyway, right? About, you know, Musi Maimane for president. Realistically, you want to be the president of South Africa?
The office of president is one of the most important institutions we have in this country. And certainly because our constitution was written with President Mandela in mind, there are inordinate powers that are put into the office of the president. I don't feel that I'm just standing because everybody certainly is doing that. It's the fashionable thing to do. But I think in some ways, there is a deep sense that one, I've been able to collaborate with many different parties all across the political spectrum in different racial groups, which I think is going to be a very, very important skill to bring to the table post this election, given that we are heading into a coalition election. Secondly, we have a vision for this country. So, you know, one of my favorite philosophers, a guy called Dallas Willard, says, worry not about the position you occupy, worry that you've got something to say or to do. And therefore, committed by a vision where in the last number of years, I've really studied the economics of this country, figured out what's wrong with our education. We don't just put a message that says a job in every home because we think it's sexy, but we think that we have a plan to fix Eskom, we have a plan to fix Transnet, We have a deliberate plan about investing in SMMEs, developing our manufacturing sector, and ensuring that more and more people can find work. I have a passion for education to make sure that we can move the pass mark from 30% to 50% and make sure that the quality of education children get from grade naught all the way to matric is improved. So the office of president gives you not only the sense of selecting the best cabinet of the future, but also delivering on that vision and that plan. And therefore, the ambition for the office is predicated simply on that plan and being able to say, let's bring South Africans together to achieve that goal.
And it sounds like a silly question to ask, but I need to do it anyway. Like, how important is that office of presidency? I mean, you gave the Mandela example, I hear you. You know, meaning that, you know, is it that important where that leader, that single leader who gets in, will have, you know, more than a 50, 60, 70% impact on what happens to the country for the next 5 years? Or am I overplaying his or her importance?
Yeah, it's not overplayed, because typically in a democracy, when your institutions are strong, then the role of the individual of the office of the president is downplayed. Because let me use a parallel example. The US can go through cycles of elections. The institution that is government continues to work. And ultimately, then the individual, whatever the decisions they make, are countered and are worked and are held accountable by the institution. In our country, the thing that we've seen in the last 15 years has been the decaying of those institutions. I feel like the last 30 years are a game of two halves. We started off building great constitutional institutions, the public protector, the national prosecuting authority, all of those institutions. The second 15 years was about eroding those institutions, which means naturally the role of then the leader becomes important. And we felt it. We felt it at least in the last number of years, where whoever is appointed the National Prosecuting Authority can determine who gets prosecuted and who doesn't. We've had to correct for that. But that tells you that the presidency and the president have got a very important role to play. So in the next 5-10 years, in rebuilding those institutions, making sure that the capability of government is restored so that the excesses of power can be curtailed and the mandate can be served, it is going to be vital that as South Africans, we pick a South African who not only is going to ensure that no one loots the money, but also ensure that the team around them can be able to charter the interests of all South Africans. And that's why it is important to elect the right person at a time such as this one.
All right. So as you talk to me, you don't just talk to me, you talk to listeners around the nation, all connected to the national pulse, but also you talk to an electorate, you're talking to a voter, and you know that, you know, you're pitching to me, you're pitching to them at the same time. Right. So how do you intend, if the case for Musi Maimane is president, we'll look through some of your policies just now, but if the case is for Musi Maimane as president, how do you intend to achieve that? Keeping in mind, well, you know the numbers. We all know the numbers about what the ANC has achieved before and the other parties. Tactically, how do you intend to achieve getting into that position where you could lead the country?
Yeah, look, I mean, I certainly believe in collaboration and working with South Africans. And I think one of the reasons we fought so much for the Electoral Amendment Bill was about making sure that we could actually make sure accountability is to citizens first and foremost, and that better coalition building can work. And I really am intent on steering a government of national unity that is a grand opposition coalition. And I was going to be clear about that, because I think post that, if we get the ANC sub 50%, I think we need to bring all South Africans together in the opposition. I think it'll be good for the ANC to be on the bench for a little bit. It will give them the space to do their project called Renewal. And I think it'll be important that if you bring a grand coalition together, not only do you free up the resources of government so that no one party can capture it, but you also allow a collaboration of ideas and the best team. The second thing is, I've already began thinking a lot about what type of cabinet you could build and what type of ministries you could do. So, for example, we desperately as a country need a ministry of digitization in the future. And then you look around the grand opposition and say, who are the best person for that? I think the economy and treasury need to come together, because you express your fiscal policy through your economic policy and ensure that you can deliver jobs. the idea of a ministry of logistics rather than just one of transport, so that you can deal with Transnet and passenger rail, so that more and more people can get to and work and goods can move around. So we've spent quite a bit of time looking at what kind of cabinet we would look, along with skilling and education, etc. And then the third dynamic to that is also about saying, well, what are then the 10 priority points that we put so that the president doesn't come to the State of the Nation ideas with fresh, grandiose visions of what Ntswalo and all of that looks like, but actually arrives there to account on that 10-point plan. And we've had a trial of it. When I was leader of the opposition in 2016, you'll remember we put together a coalition of the opposition in Johannesburg that elected Herman Mashaba, and that stayed over the 3-year period when I was leader there, because we ensured that we had a timetable, a plan which we communicated back to citizens. We will need those skills going into what will be a very, very fractious period for the next number of years as the ANC loses its power, but also as we, living in a global society that is charting a new future, and a future of uncertainty, I think it's a powerful opportunity. And lastly, Ashraf, I think if I was to make a case for myself, no leader arrives in office perfect, right? We when I left Parliament in 2019, I'd gained the experience of what Parliament looks like. I'd fought many battles. I'd succeeded in some of them and lost some of them. You need the sense of having tasted both victory and defeat. But
Well, I mean,
also the last 4 years
carry on, go
have been
ahead.
an opportunity have been an opportunity for me to do two very significant things. I got involved in business, not only because I needed to earn an income, because when you leave Parliament out of principle, you don't you I was leaving really to unemployment. So I learned an incredible fortune about how it takes to actually create a job, what frustrations business people go through. But I also furthered my academic studies, and I'm busy now completing a PhD in local governance and economic models. So you almost come to 2024 having taken the break in between, so that you can refresh, rethink, think about what needs to happen, and you arrive with better skills and the experience that has come through
So
that.
to use the analogy that you've set, so the ANC, you wanting them to get on the bench, and then you've come off the bench now, maybe refresh. So let me ask you this. You made the point about, I mean, the ANC gets 50 plus, then the discussion's over, right? For now. But if the ANC gets 50 minus, then all these other plans come into play, right? So I'll talk about some of the policies you have. I'm interested in your jobs issue, but we'll talk about that just now. Let's just stay with this before news time. What then is your plan as Build One South Africa, to take advantage of an ANC 50 minus?
I mean, I've just articulated the working tirelessly in making sure that grand opposition coalition works. And I think that's going to be crucial. You need a blend of new experienced members of parliament, and one of the things that we've done almost intentionally was allow communities to select their candidates. We've got a direct constituency-based model. Each of them had to bring 1,000 signatures, which means you've got fresh talent to work with, people who can look at our challenges fresh, but also you've got institutional experience, which means I understand how committees work, how parliament works, etc. So that's going to be crucial in being able to keep the stability of government going forward and making sure that grand opposition works, but also the global standing of South Africa. The last thing we need is to change government and govern worse than the previous ones. It almost would be more damaging than keeping status quo. And therefore, I think for the purpose of South Africa, we don't have a choice. We need to make sure the next 5 years work.
Okay,
And I'm committed to working.
we're on to news time. Just a quick one. In terms of the grand coalition working, how for you would it stick? You've got about 45 seconds to answer that.
Bring obviously all the numbers will add up to 50 plus one, but also more importantly, where parties who are not aligned from a policy point of view, they can just simply say, look, we're not going to join the coalition formally, but we could sponsor votes to elect the president and pass the budget, etc. And that coalition will be bound by a pact, which is the 10-point plan to deliver on the interests of all South Africans.
Okay, more to come in terms of some of the key policies of Build One South Africa, headed by Musi Maimane, as part of our feature that we do every Thursday around what we call Election Monitor. Right, let's get on to the business of Musi Maimane once again, the leader of Build One South Africa. To tell you, there are some people, there's lots of voice notes, we just can't play them all. There's lots of text messages, you can also tweet them out, by the way. Just tag myself, Ashraf Ganda, SFM Radio, tag Musi Maimane to use the hashtag the National Pulse, and there's a few calls we can take, but we'll do them all in the last 5 minutes as we get up to 6 o'clock. Okay, so Musi, let's then chat about the one issue that I think has certainly got me thinking whenever I see your election posters all around the suburbs that I drive in, which is a job in every home. So, do you literally mean that? And tell me how you intend doing just that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think South Africa is in many ways two nations, right? On another level, 40% of our households are living without a single job in the home. Income in that homes are based on remittances and welfare. And therefore, we have to ensure that at least there is an adult in that home who is then working. That's an important issue of dignity. And so the actual work that we've got to do is do two things. One, set the appropriate conditions. That's about keeping the lights on. And we proposed that we use SMRs to deal with base load so that electricity is a constant. Secondly, deal with logistics. That's about the movement of goods by splitting Transnet into its two component parts so that goods can move in and out of the country, and also ensure that passengers are able to get to and from work easier. Thirdly, is about skilling of your young people, because unless they've got an appropriate education, they're not going to be able to apply or be employable in any jobs. And then lastly, keep particular communities safe so that investment can flow into that. So that's the first component of making sure. The second one is, if you produce 2 million jobs in the next while, key sectors are crucial. The first one is dealing with SMMEs and dealing with the township economy. We've proposed a 220 billion rand investment into that, because we can ensure that in communities, particularly where unemployment is high, there is a sense upon which SMMEs can come through. Secondly, we've got to stimulate manufacturing out of those SMMEs. And why I raise that point is because technology such as kettle making and microwaves are archaic technology, yet South Africa's market production of those are below 4%. And therefore, if we upend that and make sure that there's higher levels of production, we can ensure that there is a job in every home. Thirdly, we want to introduce a national civilian service, which is about asking young people to spend a year post school, where they can spend 6 months in internship programs in government and 6 months working. That way you employ them for the full year and give them the full experience. And then lastly, it is indeed about making sure that when you look at the broader economy, sectors, particularly in rural communities, etc., your agricultural sectors, your tourism sectors are upended so that you can literally deliver through expanded public works program a job in every home. So for me, the target is quite simple. Let's make sure over the next 5 years, we can produce 2 million jobs. Mm. That's the focus.
Right. Let's talk about just your thoughts on skills growth. I mean, I hear the jobs part, but a lot of that depends on growth, on economic growth and skills growth of the country. Tell me about that.
So if we do all of that, setting up the right conditions, fixing our digital infrastructure, just by being able to keep the lights on and invest in digital technology by the proliferation of data and availability of data, you can already add just over 2% to that. Increase South Africa's savings and give them instruments that are able to do that and improve the savings rate. You can then be able to purchase some of the economic growth that you need. So that's on one component. The skilling part is absolutely crucial. You know, Ashraf, let's track a child's journey in this country. When a child is born in this country, many of our citizens, because of poverty, are born malnourished. So I've proposed that, in fact, we've got to improve the maternal grant so that it begins before a child is born, so that we don't have children that are born malnourished, because it downplays their ability to achieve their economic potential. Secondly, we've got to make sure the first 1,000 days are well looked after so that brain development is effective, particularly in very poor communities. I think about provinces like the Eastern Cape, the Northern Cape, where there's a proliferation of not only fetal alcohol syndrome, but malnourishment as a function of poverty. Thirdly, we've got to stimulate our ECD centers. We've got to make them mandatory for every child to go through. And whilst all of us can be desperate to get free higher education, let's make sure our ECD sector is productive so that we never repeat a stat like 8 out of 10 of our children not being able to read for meaning by the age of 10. Let's at primary school make sure that teachers, the best teachers, particularly maths and science teachers, and teachers who can teach robotics and new technical skills can be able to be employed and stay there. One of the great tragedies is when you bump into someone who says, I was a former teacher, now they're selling copiers and printers and all of that. Mm-hmm. Whilst those industries are important, we need them actually in the classroom. And then introduced a degree of blended learning so that there's more technology in the classroom. I met with the Indian government to be able to discuss how they are starting to deploy potentially artificial intelligence and personalizing learning experiences for children. It's not going to replace the teacher in the classroom, but you can ensure that there's a combination of both. You have to, in funding for education, say to yourself, how do you give each parent a voucher model so that they can choose where the best schools are? It's always sad when I, for example, having grown up in Dobsonville, Soweto, had to travel kilometers outside of Dobsonville to find an education and then have to come back. So particularly in high school status, we've got to give a form of charter education so that young people can do that, can be able to get the best schools and make the choice, reduce dropout rates, improve the pass mark from 30% to 50%, and focus yourself on even aspects such as mathematics. Here's a frightening thought. Of the million children that started school in 2012, literally 24% of them passed mathematics. Those who took mathematics passed mathematics at over 50%. The rest didn't. So it tells you the fact that we're not producing young people who can participate in an economy that is fast digitizing. And fundamentally, they need to be able to do maths, science, technology, and be able to participate in that. So we've got to streamline for that. And then, yes, I don't want for vocational training or TVET colleges, as they typically called, to be seen as dropout zones. We've got to use those as aspirational, because our economy isn't going to depend on only professionals from the sense of doctors, lawyers, and all of that who get to university. But you've got to ensure that your engineers, your plumbers, all of that, that is looked after. And one of the stats that worries me in that sector is that the throughput in TVET colleges is only at 10.4%, which tells you that actually you've got a whole ton of young kids getting into those, but only most of them actually not being able to get through it. So we've got to produce an artisan culture, but much of it depends on, as a country, us believing in our young people.
Well, I mean, you know,
the saddest things in this country
is that
this government doesn't really believe in our kids.
Okay, well, I mean, maybe that's a good point just to stop for now, because I mean, I've certainly having done an overview of what your party policies are, I mean, there's so much of it which is sound, which is actually practical, which gives a sense of that it's been very, very well thought through. But here's the big question, right? How much of it was possibly implementable before, but not implementable only because the ruling party chose not to, or they have a different policy, but can be implementable by you, or is it very difficult? What I'm saying is you know, how easy is that wish list to be attainable?
Yeah, look, you know, often the question to me is, what would you do in your first 100 days? And I think the first starting point is, if you build the capability of government by employing the best people into the state, you then give yourself the freedom to be able to implement those policies. These are not difficult things. We've got to learn from countries that have been able to do it. And you've got to make some tough decisions and tough choices. You know, you've got to say to yourself that within a fiscally constrained environment with limited growth, how then do you prioritize spending in certain things? So our education spend isn't a problem, but we've protected senior administrators to a point where you kind of come through senior sections of government where people are overpaid, but their delivery is low, whereas people who are doing the work itself are not. It's like the same in multiple departments, home affairs, etc. It's policy decisions that then force you to say, even in policing, how do you devolve certain powers so that a police station can work and ultimately focus on crime fighting and bringing intelligence lower down to the ground. Those are policy positions that don't have to cost you much, but you can evolve some of your legislative framework, give more powers back to provinces, but also ensure that you can merge policing with metro police, etc., so that you increase the force. Okay. So some of it is about where do you prioritize spend, some of it is about changing policy, but I do think in the next 5 years, it's a very practicable thing to do.
Okay, we're chatting to Musi Maimane, the leader of Build One South Africa. We're going to stop at 6 o'clock, which means it's incredibly tight. I mean, I wish we could speak for another hour. We certainly do not have that luxury. In fact, in many ways, it reflects the type of deadlines that the country faces in solving its problems, like it's all urgent, urgent, urgent. So maybe time for two calls, two WhatsApps. That's probably the best I can do. So if you intend to call or WhatsApp, just send that message right away. I'll see what I can do and squeeze it in before 6 o'clock. But Musi, here's the thought, right? In terms of the policies that you've put out again, that is, you know, premised like manifestos. It's premised on not just your party, but all other parties winning an election. How does that plan then change when your party, A, doesn't get the 50 plus, or your party then does get the 50 plus within a coalition with, as you know, a whole series of other multi-parties who need to negotiate policies that gets all of you to sit on one table? Practically, how would that work out?
So on first, on opposition, let's assume current status quo continues. Mm. Well, I'll be sending most of our MPs to focus on education, to focus on finance, because I think those are two critical components of government. We've got to fix for those, and we've got to work hard at that. But let's assume we do get to the 50 plus one, which is that grand opposition coalition that we keep speaking about. I do certainly think that you've got to steer away from ideological positions where you are extremist on either end. Come with pragmatic, practical solutions for a country. If you disagree with me that we need to skill the country, then I'm not sure what universe you are living in. If you disagree that at least let's keep the lights on by introducing a degree of technology that deals with baseload, then we can't work together. Otherwise, we'll govern worse. So I do think on a 10-point plan, we're able to find each other with parties because they're very pragmatic and practical. And that's why we've put ourselves as the centrist party that can hold the best of both public and private sector.
Are there parties that you can't work with?
Parties that are corrupt and racist would exclude themselves just by nature. And I'll let the viewers decide which parties are.
Okay, and we'll see what happens when you sit at the table. Just your quick thoughts on basic income grant?
We were one of the few that advanced it in the beginning. I think that given the fact that just over half of our citizens live below the upper poverty line, there cannot be a debate about whether we need a floor income that people cannot dip below. So I would certainly look at introducing that. And if for functions of affordability, what I would also do is make it a targeted one, particularly in communities that face profound poverty, so that you don't dip below. But here's the next crucial thing, is that if you want to introduce a basic income grant, it cannot be means tested in the sense that you don't want to dissuade people from looking for work and the condition that if they find work, they lose their income. Mm. You've got to almost be able to ensure that it adds towards the whatever income they would derive from finding a job.
What's the single, you know, you spoke about 100 days, just so ignore the 100 day factor. What's the single biggest thing that you either as the leader or you as a huge influence within a coalition will want to implement ASAP?
Education, education, education. Let's fix that. Because if we don't, the future of our young people is doomed. And then we go back to literally the trajectory of a child who's born poor remains exactly the same as what they were pre-94, which is a crime. So let's fix for that and ensure that we can fix it. And I've already mentioned the fact that building a capability of the state and then dealing with the economic issues is going to be vital. So I would really look at skilling our South Africans.
Okay. And quick thought, A, affirmative action, B, just, you know, 30 seconds.
Sorry, say that again.
Your thoughts on BEE and affirmative action, 30-second comment?
Redress is important. These are policies that, in the way they've been constructed by the government, have not worked. But we've got a policy called Build One Economy that looks at how do you do inclusion. And I've said to myself, I'm going to introduce a jobs and justice fund to which companies can contribute towards so that we can fund entrepreneurs and fund education.
Okay,
that's the focus.
Let's get to two very, very quick calls. So we got Mfundo and Solly. If you come on, please be 30 seconds only. We can't really do more than that. Mfundo, go ahead from Cape Town. Hi.
Hi, Ashraf and Musi. I'm going to have a quick two questions. What is Musi putting on the table when it comes to land distribution without compensation? And secondly, education, I hear you, Musi. However, what about the status of free education? What are your state? What is your take on that? As good as one is?
Okay, got that. In fact, what I'll do is let's get Musi. I'll get the next call as well. Thanks, Mfundo. Solly from Cape Town, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Ashraf, and good afternoon, Mr. Maimani.
Afternoon.
Who I know well. You know, I'll be very quick because I don't have time. On the Stephen Crutter show, Mr. Maimani denied that there was a genocide going on, and an hour later when I confronted him, it was a different picture. Can he clearly tell the world now, is there a genocide after 200 days, yes or no?
Okay, got that. Solly, thanks for that. Right, Musi, you got a minute to answer both those questions.
On the first, I think land is a function of restitution, and therefore I don't think we need an amendment of the constitution. Expropriation already exists within our constitution, so let's focus on ensuring that we do the redistributive work that must happen in there. In terms of free higher education, the policy is quite simple. If your parents were not able to go to university post, if your parents were not able to go to university pre-1994, then the state must be able to fund your education. And the first time you start to pay back is when you find a job. On the third, which is the Middle Eastern crisis, I'm the first one to admit the fact that they're suffering. The suffering of Palestinians, that the matter of whether there's a genocide is a function that the courts are busy dealing with. And therefore, it would be premature of me, as having fought and fought for the enforcement of the court system, even in this country, to make a pronouncement about it ahead of time.
Okay. Lastly, why Build One South Africa? Potential voter listening to us, deciding on whether they should consider you. What's your pitch?
They must consider Build One South Africa because on the ballot, we're the only party that can bring all South Africans together. Because when you look at the ballot, there are black parties, there are white parties, Indian colored. That's not the vision for this country. The vision is to bring South Africa together so that rich and poor can work together to deliver prosperity. And Musi Maimani and Build One South Africa have got credible, ethical leaders who can deliver on that vision and ensure there's a job in every hand.
Okay, we'll see what happens on May 30, whether you'll still remain on the bench or you've come off the bench. Musi Maimani, appreciate your time and thanks for giving it off and good chatting to you today. And I'm sure we'll have further chats in the build-up to the elections. That's Musi Maimani from Build One South Africa. Perhaps you may want to tweet him and me and SFM Radio even now, and maybe we'll get a chance to get him to answer some questions even on the X platform as well. But it's 6 o'clock now, time for the news with Greg Hose.